Hello, and welcome to the Writers and Illustrators of the Future podcast. This is John Goodwin, your host. This podcast is dedicated to the aspiring writer or artist and will provide inspiration and tips from top professionals in the field, along with contest winners and a few surprise guests. Today, this is the very first person that walked across the stage for Writers of the Future on Volume 1 and received his certificate of recognition. Welcome, Dean Wesley Smith.
Thanks for having me.
Yes.
Fun to be here.
Yeah, it's great. And you've been a judge for Writers of the Future. You were the first person to receive the recognition on it. And you've got some of the most amazing, incredible publishing credentials of anybody. So I'm very anxious to be able to have this interview.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, the key is just being around for a long time.
So the first thing you mentioned when we were preparing on this was you said a special goal. And I think this is just itself just spectacular. So what is that special goal you had for your 70th year?
I decided we have our own publishing company, my wife and I. My wife is Christine Catherine Rush, and we have our own publishing company that we set up when the Kindle started. You know, it's been, 12, 13, 14 years
now.
And we have quite a few employees and things, and we have almost 1,000 books that we put out through WMG Publishing of one form or another, mostly just me and Chris.
Right.
I decided that I wanted to really challenge myself with the writing and everything else on my 70th year on the planet. And so I decided to put out 70 major books, publish 70 books in my 70th year. That includes novels, collections. I count novellas because they're, 25 or 30,000 words. And also things that I edit. Books that I edit that I am the editor and I have my name on the cover. Basically, the idea is if my name is in big letters on the cover, it counts. I'm not counting short stories because that would be too easy because I write 50 or 60 short stories a year just on average. So I'm doing that this year for 70 major books, and I am 1 month away from my 71st birthday, and I am only 4 books short at the moment. I'm almost going to make it, and I have 4 collections that I'm putting together really quick that, because I have a lot of short stories, so I'm putting these 4 collections, and that'll be the last 4. So I will make 70 in my 70th year.
That's amazing.
It's because it's possible with indie publishing these days. And so I will publish more books in 1 year than most writers do in their entire career.
Absolutely amazing. Yeah. Absolutely amazing.
Yeah. Plus about 50 short stories.
Yeah. Well, you've got a magazine that a monthly issue where you have a very limited payroll because you only have one author.
Me. Yeah, it's called Smith's Monthly. I am, frighteningly enough, I don't know how it did this, but I'm on issue 55. And it's the same size as Asimov or Analog or one of those. I do it every month, and it is, I put usually a novel in it, and then I'll have something I'm serializing, either a nonfiction book or something like that, and then 4 or 5 original short stories every issue, month after month after month.
Wow.
And I'm on issue 55 right now. I took a couple-year hiatus when Chris got sick. So I actually, between I think it was issue 42 and 43, there was a 2.5-year gap where I just stopped, took care of Chris, got her back healthy, and then started back up again. But I'm on 55 now, and it's still going.
Amazing.
Some of those monthly deadlines are kind of rough. But yeah.
Yeah. That's great.
It does pretty well with subscriptions to it. It's a big magazine. It's the size of a double column. It's a big magazine. Yeah. It's like a regular newsstand magazine.
That's amazing. I mean, you epitomize the definition of a professional writer.
Yeah, I'm prolific.
Yes,
I'm considered one of the most prolific writers that's functioning still. That's still alive. There's been, but I'm not the most prolific because there are people who are far more prolific than I am. But I'm in the top 10.
Absolutely. Yeah. Now, when we talked earlier on, this is years ago.
it has been.
Yes. We discussed, the writing habits of L. Ron Hubbard. Mm-hmm. And you said, at one point, at the beginning of your career, this is way back at the beginning, because we're almost 4 decades old now as the Writers of the Future.
Yeah.
But that one of your objectives was emulating Elwin Hubbard and his speed of writing, because he was a really a high output author. Describe that a little bit, as like, you know, what you got from him as an author, and, you know, in terms of his speed of writing and putting out versus how you've come to go.
The pulp writers, as he was back in the pulp days, you know, and he transitioned into the book days, but he started off in the pulp, and that's when he was really prolific.
Right.
I actually came up studying, because I'm a collector. I used to be. I've kind of trimmed down now. Yeah. But I studied the pulp writers, and he was one of the top pulp writers. There was Lester Dent, who did the Doc Savages, and Perry Mason, who did the Perry Mason guys, which was Earl Stanley Gardner, and also A.A. Fair, which is also Earl Stanley Gardner. So there were five or six that were like L. Ron Hubbard. They were very prolific, and I studied them all. And what I liked about L. Ron Hubbard's work is that he crossed genres. You know, he would write Westerns, he would write science fiction, he would, you know, and he would move on the genres and sometimes move magazines and things. I really like that about him. I am the same way. I have a very popular mystery series. I'm sort of known for my Star Trek back in the day, back in the previous century. Things like that. And so I'm that kind of writer where I really move. I can't really stay. I mean, I have a lot of series that have 10 or 12 or 15 books in the series, but that's taken me 10 or 12 or 15 years to write that many books in that series, because I will write one book in a series and then I'll completely move to another genre and do another series and do something different. And so I like that about Hubbard a lot, is that unlike the Lester Dent or Earl Stanley Gardner, who only wrote the legal fiction mostly, I liked switching around. And so he was the top, like, oh, that's possible, you know, and I liked that a lot.
Yeah, there's one of the essays that he wrote called Manuscript Factory, and he went through and he actually analyzed how much he made per word, per genre, because different genres, different magazines paid different rates. And so he found, he worked out, and it would fluctuate, you know, over the 20 years or so, that, you know, I'm making more money per word on Western or on mystery or science fiction or fantasy type thing.
Yeah, I don't even really pay attention on that. I think I did early on, especially when I was working traditional publishing. But I don't pay attention on that anymore. I just write what I want to write. And, you know, and I feel I'll have more passion and I'll be there. So I don't write to market at all anymore. Now, this is coming from me, who wrote 35 Star Trek books and, you know, and I wrote Men in Black and I wrote, you know, Spider-Man and X-Men and all these books to market. And I was hired by the publishers to write specific books. That was, again, back in the 90s and late 80s. And now, since I paid my dues on that, I don't really like that restraint of what it does on my creative voice. I would rather just write what I want to write. If I actually follow that now, what I should be writing is my Cold Poker Gang series, which is a mystery series, basically retired detectives in Las Vegas solving cold cases. I don't know, 12 or 13 books now. When I started writing it, I just published them. I would call it publishing dark, publishing cold. I never did anything. I never promoted them. I never did it. I just put them out. And they kind of were selling a couple books a month. You know, each book was selling two or three copies a month. And I didn't care. I just didn't care. And then one day, it kind of just exploded. And I went to the top of all the bestseller lists and everything else with it. And it's my best-selling series. So if I was writing only for money and only what was paying me the best, I'd be writing only that mystery series. But no, I write science fiction series and stuff that, you know, sell one or two copies a month.
Right.
And I'm perfectly fine. And I don't care. I just what I want to write. And so I think it takes a while to get to that point in comfort with what you're doing, although I really try to teach that you don't pay attention to writing to market. You pay attention to writing what you love. But as I say that, of course, I get invited into collections and I get invited like to write for the story on Bob Eggleton's wonderful cover on, what was that, 35, I think.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so that's writing to market.
Yeah.
And so I will sometimes go, oh, yeah, that would be fun. And I will write to market. So there's a balance in there that everybody has to find as a writer.
Yeah. And one thing is particular with Elron Hubbard, when he was doing that, he was writing 3 days a week, 2 hours a day to produce his 100,000 words a month. And he was doing that to pay for his research instead of his doing on his more serious works. So he had to go for what's going to get him.
What's going to pay the bills.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So I know that one. Every writer goes through that phase. Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I wrote some books that to this day I kind of wonder, what was I thinking? And I was thinking dollars and cents is what I was thinking.
Yeah.
And how to pay the rent for next month. So.
Yeah, so I mean, that's a very, it is.
You got to do it.
You've got to do it. You're the, if that's going to be how you're going to pay the bills and keep the roof.
I went freelance in 1987, and for the next 20 years before I got to this enviable position that I can write what I want, because I have enough money and I can do what I want now, you know, I wrote a lot to market, just exactly like Elron.
Yeah.
You know, going, oh, that's going to pay. That pays the most. And
yeah,
I took some jobs ghosting for major writers that, you know, would pay a half a year in bills just by writing a novel for some major writer and that got sick or something. And they'd already, the publisher already had the book promoted and they needed the book. They needed the content and the writer wasn't providing the content. So they would come to me and hire me to, they knew I could do it fast and I could imitate that author. And so I've had number one New York Times bestsellers under another author's name, because, you know, just I could imitate. So skills, you got to pick up skills if you're going to make a living.
Yeah. So now you've also grown with a workshop that you've got, or is it multiple workshops?
What occurred is Chris and I, back in the 90s, people wanted to know, because we had had Pulp House Publishing, which was an independent publisher. It was the fifth largest publisher in science fiction, fantasy, and horror, period. Among all of them. And that was about 5 years running, is that we were at that status. And we had started it from two young writers, just started it out of the blue, and it kind of got crazy and grew. And we had 19 employees in a two-story office building. It was just, it was stupid is what it was. But we had a real good time, and we learned a lot. And when it closed down in the mid-90s, what occurred was Chris and I, people were asking us these publishing questions. How do we do this? How do we do that? So we went around at conventions and just did an hour or 2 hour talk. And they people started calling it the Dean and Chris Show. And then we started up in, we lived in Lincoln City, Oregon, on the Oregon coast. And we said, well, we're tired of going out. Why don't we bring people here? So we started some workshops. And this was in 1999 was the first one. And then after a while, people said, well, we can't come all the way to the Oregon coast. Can you put this online? So about 12, 13 years ago, I started an online class. And I said, I'm only going to do this for a little while. Well, it's now 15 years later. And it's on Teachable, which is a teaching platform. And I record videos and for topics. And we have all kinds of stuff. We have regular workshops. We have you name it. And on almost any topic in writing and in publishing, in craft and in publishing, it's on there somewhere. And we're constantly coming up with new stuff. And, you know, we it's just great fun. I think we have 200 or 300 different classes now. So you can pretty well find anything you're looking for.
Yeah.
And you can find it all, information on how to get to it on my website, which is deanwesleysmith.com. And, but, yeah, it's continuous and it's grown. I never thought I'd still be doing this 15 years later.
Right.
You know, and but it's every time we start a new workshop and then Chris and I sit down and we put it together and we lay it all out and how do we teach this? How would we get this across? How do we get this concept across to writers of all levels? And so we're constantly learning. And so this is keeping us learning and fresh and challenged and everything else because, I mean, right now we're doing something that most people wouldn't even know what it is. And it's called power words and how long, you know, we always teach the top level. So how does someone like a Dean Koontz or a Stephen King or someone like that that's working at the top of their craft, how do they use power words to convey emotion to a reader's subconscious? That's the kind of workshops we're doing right now. And, you know, and it's everything from how do you pull readers into stories to how do you publish things like that. We just, we do it all. And it takes, you know, a couple hours of my day every day. on this, all the teaching, and but it's all recorded, and then once I record it, it's there.
It's there for...
And I do, on some of the classes, there's homework where I'll read people's stuff and things, and so, but... Yeah, it's
so that's
it's
a paid workshop that people sign up for.
Yeah, they're paid. They're all paid. Yeah, we have one free one where we teach how writers to get on Kickstarter and do a Kickstarter for their novels or stuff.
Yeah,
that's the only free class we have. All the rest you got to pay because it's not worth it if you don't pay.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
bottom line.
Yeah,
people don't value something they don't pay for.
Well, that's good. So that's how you've transitioned as well to. I guess part of paying it forward, mm-hmm. making it for possible for that.
Yeah, and other things like what you guys do with Writers of the Future here. I'd love to come down and be part of this.
Yeah. Now, you were at the original, the very first workshop in Taos, New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
So what, a little bit of, like, what was that like? Was that your first workshop?
Well, no, I'd started some workshops before. They were, you know, the bootstrap workshops where you just, your friends that want to be writers get together. That was the first professional level workshop. And I started to realize at that point that wow, this is valuable. What that was Algis Budrys put this together because he knew that the writers coming through Writers of the Future, like I was a couple years earlier, needed some professional advice and advice from L. Ron Hubbard and, you know, and other stuff like that. And so he invited 12 writers that he thought were going to make it, you know, that came out of Writers of the Future and, or like my wife, Chris, that's just where I met Chris, was at a Writers of the Future.
Yeah.
AJ actually had me pick her up in Albuquerque. And
you never put her down.
No, we've been together for 35 years since.
Yeah.
And it's just... it was invaluable. It was Algis Budrys, Jack Williamson, Grandmaster, Fred Pohl, Grandmaster, Gene Wolfe, you know.
Yeah.
And the four of them and the 12 of us beginners.
Yeah, I mean, all four of them judges for the contest.
And we had basically just spent a week with them. And mostly it was going over articles and some of the teachings that, you know, that AJ had taken out of L. Ron Hubbard's stuff. I think you guys are still pretty much doing the same class.
Exactly.
And it was unbelievably valuable. I mean, that was the turning point, not only meeting Chris, but having that professional advice from four people that I had admired my entire life. I mean, I think AJ's book was, Algis Budrys' book was one of the first adult books I read, you know, as a 10 or 12-year-old back in the 50s. And so, you know, having Algis Budrys, Jack Williamson, who published his first short story in 1928, you know, I mean, you know, you don't get better.
Yeah.
And that's what's going on, what you guys hear. I mean, you have, what, Scott Card and Tim Powers I mean, you just don't get better. And then all the people coming
plus
in.
Plus, we got all the people now who won the contest, came from the contest, like yourself, Eric mm-hmm. Flint, Dave Farland. He was mm-hmm. the grand prize winner in Volume 3.
Yep.
Sean Williams, he's not here this year, but he was a winner. So we've got several of our judges are winners, or you people like... Rob Sawyer, mm-hmm. who, although he didn't win the contest, he was given a critique from AJ
mm-hmm.
that he used that turned one of his short stories into a novel that then disqualified him for the contest because it became professionally published.
My wife never made it into the book either. Kevin Anderson never made it into the book. It's really hard to get in this book. I mean, it, when you actually look back at it, but they're both judges.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so that's the kind of thing that is really valuable to the new writers coming in. And the, to be honest with you, the deadline. I mean, I don't think you guys realize that quarterly deadline, how many people are, you know, my students that are coming in, you know, I don't consider them my students. They're just writers I'm helping.
Right.
You know, but, you know, every quarter when it comes up, it's like, I got to get my story done for Writers of the Future. I got to do, you know, and it drives writers to write. And I don't know how much you guys realize what it drives out there in the real world. Those deadlines are really motivating. You know.
Yeah, what's interesting is our review on Writers of the Future Volume 35 from one of the top library review mm-hmm. publications said that nothing has contributed more towards the genre of science fiction and fantasy mm-hmm. than Writers of the Future.
100% agree. Yeah, I mean, Hubbard's idea for this contest was just off the charts brilliant, you know, and you look at it. Now, I copied the contest. You guys know that.
Yeah.
You know, when I was at Star Trek, working at Star Trek and writing for Star Trek, and John Ordover, the editor, was trying to figure out how to get, because there was only five of us in the whole Star Trek stable at that point in time. They couldn't figure out a way to get other writers. And I said, well, let's just imitate Writers of the Future. And he goes, can we do that? And I said, well, you got to set it up as a contest because of the copyright issues and everything else like that. And he said, so he just looked at what you guys were doing here at Writers of the Future and set it up. And that's where Strange New Worlds came from. And he came to me and he said, Dean, you can edit this. You're an editor. And I went, well, yeah, I could. You know, I edited Pulp House. I edited VB Tech and other stuff. And I said, yeah, I could do that. And so for 10 years, we had a yearly book imitating, and it was only writers that were brand new, that didn't have three published stories. It was exactly what you guys were doing, but it was only Star Trek stories. And I got to read about, I don't know, I think we got 2,000-3,000 a year of these Star Trek stories. But we only had one deadline. It was only a year, yeah. Once a year. And they would turn in these stories, and I would have to weed it down to 17. And for Strange New Worlds. Now Strange New Worlds is going to be the new series, you know, the new Star Trek series. But for 10 years, I edited Strange New Worlds, which is why I couldn't be a judge here, because I couldn't be a judge on Writers of the Future and be the only editor on Strange New Worlds.
Yeah.
Because both of them were beginning writer contests. And then when that ended after 10 years, then I could
finally say, yes,
I could be a judge.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, but it was great fun. So you guys—
Did this accomplish its purpose?
Oh, 100%.
So yeah. Now the stable grew. And
I was, for the longest time, the most prolific Star Trek writer. I have 35 Star Trek books. I mean, I didn't think anybody was going to beat that. I bought in the very first issue a story from Dayton Ward, and then he sold me one in the second issue, and then he sold me one in the third issue, and he couldn't sell anymore then because he was out of the rules. And he is now the most prolific. I think he's just gone by me on Star Trek writers, on authors. He's one of the best. He's unbelievably good, which is why I bought three stories from him.
Yeah.
But It brought in a whole new stable of young writers and then built the Star Trek community.
Which is what, obviously, the Rise of the Future does.
It brings in the bigger world.
Exactly.
You do it in the bigger world. Star Trek did it in the Star Trek world. And, yeah, it worked out 100%. And so Hubbard's idea was just brilliant. It was just brilliant. You know, and you look back on it and go, how in the heck do you guys survive in 38 years of this now? That all by itself is mind-numbing. No, I don't know of any other anthology series in science fiction, fantasy, or anywhere that survived 38 years. It just, some of them would go 5 or 10, but I know of none other. You're the only one.
And it keeps on getting bigger. We're up, I don't say on set, but we get thousands of entries a quarter now.
Oh, I would put a wager.
Yeah.
From just what I see through the classes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's all in that. And then the illustrator contest too, which has just grown immensely. And also because of, folks like yourself who just, you spread out there and they know that if you put your name to it, then it's like, wow, it's got you and, like I said, Scott Card, Tim Powers, all these,
we've been around a while.
The behemoths of science fiction and fantasy.
We're the survivors of science fiction. Because you look at that very first one that I went to that was at Chasen's. Mm-hmm. Most people don't even know what that restaurant was anymore now, but it was really famous that you guys got in that first time.
I walked
in the door and there was Robert Silverberg and Jack Williamson and Harlan Ellison, and they were all there at that first.
A.E. Van Vogt was there.
Van Vogt, yep, all of them. And I mean, I remember as a young writer and looking at this table of all these giants at the time and thinking, oh God, I'd love to just talk to one of them, and they ended up spreading out and talking to all of us. But now it's, all of them are gone, which is really sad. They were all became my friends over the years. Now you look and say, well, it must be really weird to have Todd McCaffrey and Dean Smith and Kevin Anderson and all that sitting there at a table and these young writers coming in and going,
And that's exactly what
they do. I remember that feeling so well from 38 years ago. I remember it. And, and now I realize, and Kevin realizes it too. And so we all make time to go try to talk to the writers if they'll just talk to us. They're usually too afraid to talk to us.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, we're just like you are. We started the same way, We just have survived.
Which is what they're hoping to be able to do
and
to learn from you and to be able to make that transition from being aspiring, now they're professional because they've just been published in a professional publication.
Yep.
As the contest grows, the people that are entering, the ones that when the winnowing process gets done, like I said, there's many, 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 you know, that get winnowed out of it. But we now have a couple hundred honorable mentions a quarter because there's that many people, and it's just the line between.
Well, the quality's up too.
Exactly.
The quality. As a judge, I'm noticing as the years have gone by, the quality has come up. And, you know, because they're, you know.
Exactly.
I mean, I would edit differently if I was saying, you know, because I get stories, which is the way it should be. I get stories, you know, as the judge, and I'll get, what, six or eight stories sometimes from.
Eight, yeah.
And I'll look at them and go, no. No. Oh, God, I love this story. No. You know, because it's just taste. When it gets up to that level of writing, it becomes taste.
Yeah.
And my taste is different than whatever Dave's doing or, yeah. or the editors, you know, before I get it. And that's the way it should be. You know, I think it's – I mean, if I looked and went, oh, I like all eight of these, I would be in trouble. You know,
yeah.
But now I'm finding that I'm looking and going, I got to weed this down to three, and I got five I really like. How do I do that?
Yeah.
You know, and so I'd publish all five of these. Yeah. You know.
Which
can't,
is
can't do that.
Yeah, which is one thing that's good about the honorable mentions that we have now, like I said, because there are so many great stories. But when people start putting that on their resumes, then it automatically takes them out of the slush pile from other editors.
This is right.
You know, because it's grown so much in recognition and just recognition of when someone gets that level within Writers of the Future, because it's all known now that it's blind judging. So.
Yeah.
If they get it, it's not because they're a name or they're something else. It's just strictly raw, their work that makes it.
Yeah. And what's really amazing is I haven't yet got a story that I recognize. You know, I would keep thinking, oh, some of these stories, because I've read so many beginning writer stories through all the workshops, but so far the ones that have come in, I haven't recognized. So it's just probably been luck. You know, I'm sure at some point I will get one of my students, you know, that'll come popping through and I'll have to
recuse yourself.
I'll have to decline and step back. But, you know, it's just kind of.
Yeah, Brandon Sanderson had that happen a few years ago with Darcy Stone.
Mm-hmm.
She was his student. He recognized it, so I have to recuse myself. I can't vote.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I haven't had that happen yet, but I'm expecting it at some point.
At some point, no doubt.
Because I have so many people that have taken classes from me.
Yeah.
You know.
So now, as an instructor, are there any particular things that when you go out or people write to you that they like, the most common questions that you're asked to provide instruction on or direction on?
I don't think there's a common.
Okay.
So much. It's more on the publishing side because the writing side, you know, is you got to learn how to pull readers into stories. And we have a class, two or three classes on that called depth. We call it depth. It's pulling the reader down in depth. Mm. If you're only writing across the surface, the readers can leave. But if you got them at the bottom of the ocean, bottom of the lake, it's a long ways before they can actually leave. And so, you know, we teach that a lot. But it's the traditional publishing, the four publishers that are left, and indie publishing, where you do it yourself and you're completely in control and you learn how to do everything. Most of the questions come in some fashion or another with that. I'm a person that sold 106 books to traditional publishers,
right. Okay,
and edited for pocketbooks at different times. I completely discourage all beginning writers going that way because the traditional publishers will buy all their rights. It'll take them years and years and years to get through the contract phase and the agent phase and all the other stuff. It's just crazy how bad that system's become. I wouldn't be a writer if that system was the only system still. Over in indie, you got to learn how to do it yourself. So there's learning curves that you got to jump through. But that, you get a lot more money. You can write anything you want and you're free to, and if there's a mistake, it's your mistake. It's not some editor or some, you know, printer or something. I mean, I had one book in traditional publishing that came out that someone had gotten mad down in the production area and they had just shifted every other chapter with another book. And so my book literally never got published, but it was just my book was sort of like every other chapter, and they scattered a couple chapters. They were really mad. And it went clear through, came out with the cover, with my name on the cover. And of course, it wasn't a big enough book to bother. They didn't reprint it. And so, you know, I'd written this entire book, and no one could ever read it. And that's the kind of stuff that happens in traditional publishing, where you make that, you know, you are responsible for what your product you're putting out. So most of the questions I get are between going that way or going traditional.
Yeah.
And traditional, you can have your book published, and it can be up and published within a couple of weeks. Traditional is going to take you 2-3 years just for the one book. So, I mean, if I was thinking, oh, I'm going to publish 70 books in my 70th year, and I was a traditional publisher, I would be lucky to get 3 or 4, you know, but I can do it in indie, and I make a lot more money.
Yes.
I make so much more money in indie than I ever did in traditional.
So traditional is like, what, 10 to 15%?
On your royalties?
Yes.
Oh, it's 8, 10, 12, depending on what your contract is. And then most people don't realize that there are discounts in it. So like if they sell your book in Costco, you get nothing. All those writers get so happy that there's a big pallet of their books in Costco, and I'm going, no, you're not making a nickel. You will not make a nickel on that book. Your advances are basically what you make. If you get your book in Costco as an indie writer, which is very possible and fairly easy to do, you make it all. You make 70% and or higher, depending. A lot of the books we sell, we make 95%. There's only like a credit card fee.
But that's through WMG.
Through WMG, and we also sell on Amazon. We sell around the world. When I was in traditional, I was only selling North American. So only people in North America, Canada, and the United States could get my books. Well, in WMG, we sell worldwide. We have people reading our books in India and China and Brazil and South America and everywhere else. We're literally worldwide, just like you guys are. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, you publish other authors too?
Nope.
Your own?
Well, we do in our magazines. We have Fiction River and we have Pulp House magazine, where I'm the editor of Pulp House. And so we have other authors in that. And we do anthologies. Like last year, we did a series of cat books. We did a Kickstarter to start it, and then we did one book a month of cat stories, and it was great fun. Chris and I were the editors, and that had other authors in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I know like that. Kevin has got Wordfire Press, and he publishes
other people,
and those are different numbers to what you've got because he basically
it's WMG is just me and Chris,
right.
And then our magazines that publish other people. Kevin actually publishes other people's novels and everything else at Wordfire. It's sort of a different approach, but he publishes the same way we do. It's an indie.
But in terms of like as an author, how much you're going to get? Because author going through Wordfire, you're not going to get 95%.
You're going to get 50 of what Kevin makes. You're going to get half of what Kevin makes.
Yeah.
With WMG, we make it all.
Sure.
It's just our stuff. We pay authors up front at professional rates. Kind of like what you guys do, and then with the writers and writers of the future, and you pay them one-time fee, and then whatever the book makes, whether you lose money or make money is, you know, whatever the book makes. Right. That's the way we are. We pay one-time fee. Kevin actually pays royalties, and that's a difference. That's a more of a traditional setup, but he's regretted that, I think, a few times because of the paperwork and the book work. It's unbelievable how much that is. We just get a check-in.
You just need to find the right app and download the app and just plug in the stuff
and spit it out. We just
not.
Yeah. Well, you guys are a one-author press plus Writers of the Future.
Right.
Yeah. That's what Chris and I, we're two-author press plus Pulp House.
Right.
You know, and so that's what we do. Yeah, it's just kind of, we're very similar. You guys are indie press. We're an indie press.
Right.
Yeah.
So now I'm taking it now to the number of people in your situation in life are few and far between. So let's go back 30 years to where you were a younger pup, 40 years. At the beginning of your career, which is what most of the people listening to this will be, more able to appreciate. So the industry's changed a lot now. Indie is definitely, from what we just talked at the beginning, this is, for your perspective, the way to go.
It's about 80-90% of the books being published now.
So now on doing that, What are some of the, you know, the advice on how to do that in terms of preparing yourself for that as well? Because you can't just say, here's my book, now I'm going to go to Amazon and upload my book and sell it there.
Sure, you can. That's exactly what you do.
but in terms of getting a book sold then versus just uploading it, there's other things that are incumbent upon you as an author to do these days that wasn't so important back with the traditional lines.
Yeah. Well, it became important when the traditional started jettisoning things like their Salesforce and all that. They used to have a Salesforce back in the previous century. They now don't have any Salesforce. One of the things you have to do is basically 20 books. I know there's actually a writer's conference called 20 to 50, and that 20 basically write 20 books, make $50,000 a year. That title of their conference is actually pretty accurate. There is a reason why, and it's got to be 20 major books, you know, and so it's novels or collections or novellas published, not short stories. They help, but they're not considered in that 20. The 20 is for discovery, discoverability. And that's a phrase you'll hear getting kicked around, but it's actually very accurate. Think of it this way. If you're a brand new author, it's like setting up a brand new store. Okay, and so you're going to set up, I use a bakery. You're going to set up a bakery, and you're going to put your sign out, you know, on the street, and a customer walks through the door, and you got all the shelves and everything on the wall, but you only got one product, and it's sitting over on the shelf, one product. What does the customer do? Well, they come in, and they turn around and go right back out, because there's only one thing on all these empty shelves, okay? When you get to 20 products on your shelves, because you're a store, you got to think of yourself as a store. When you get 20 products on your shelf, suddenly it looks and the customers will stay. And they'll say, oh, I don't like, oh, but I like that one. And they'll start going between products. That's really where you start getting that discoverability. So any of the work you do in the first 5 or 10 books is worthless. It's absolutely worthless. So my suggestion to young writers is to just sit down and write and finish and put it up on Amazon and on Kobo, and Kobo will get it around the world. Amazon will get it some around the world. And then there's also a third spot to put it, which is called D2D. It is digital to something. But anyhow, they are all around, and they have all of, they're an aggregator, and they basically will draft to digital. That's what it's called. I knew I'd remember, old memory. Draft to digital, and they basically are an aggregator, and so you can put it up on draft to digital, and then hit all kinds of buttons, and suddenly your book will be in India, and it'll be in a distributor in Europe, and it'll be, you know, and it's, and so we only load to three places: Amazon, draft to digital, and Kobo, and that's called putting it out wide, and you get your book all over the world in all the English-speaking countries that buy, and so it's very, very easy.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to have your book proofed. You don't need it edited. In fact, that's weird. And you don't need it edited, and you do not, you just need to find all the typos that you can find. So have a friend read it for typos, and then go from there.
So the subject of, you know, this is Hollywood Boulevard.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, what the heck?
Yeah. So on social media, having your own website, having Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, how does that play in from your perspective?
You need your own website for your author name so people can find you and find what books you've done.
Mm-hmm.
I fall down on that a little bit. I don't keep my books up. But we also have a website for our press, WMG Publishing, and that is extremely well done. You can search for my series or search under my name or search Science Fiction Dean, you know, and that sort of stuff. And because we have about 1,000 titles and, you know, and the blurbs and how, and then right there on that, it will click through to wherever you want to buy your book or whatever mode you want to buy it in. The draft to digital also has a great service that's free, and that is that you can, and I don't remember the name of it, but it's connected with draft to digital, books to read, that's what it's called. And you basically, you plug your book in there with your cover and your, you know, your ebook and probably a PDF, and its little spider goes out all over the world and finds where your book's available and puts it all in one thing. And so books to read, you can give that link to your customers, and they'll click on it and they can find what device or what store they want it. And it's all in one place. And it's called Books to Read. And Drafted Digital does it for free. But it's tremendous. It's made it so easy for all of us, you know, because when we started off, we had to say, well, you can get it in Amazon, you can get it here. And you had to put all that on your website. Now you just put the Books to Read link and they can get it anywhere they want it in the world. And it's really easy. So basically, you got to do that website. Good to have maybe a little social media presence. That helps. So you can announce your book. But in your first 20 books, don't bother to promote. Just write. Just be focusing on getting to be a better writer. And the better writer you become and learn craft and read other writers a lot. And then once you get to that, when you get about 20, then you've got a store that has something on the shelves. And then you can say, hey, folks, come in and look at my store. And then you can start promoting and advertising your store. And there's lots of ways, and it's always changing.
Definitely.
And by the time you get 20 books written, you'll have learned all this other stuff too.
Yeah.
It's just sort of, you don't try to learn it all at once. You just let it grow. So.
Plus, it also helps having people like you or Kevin or all the other judges for the contest are totally willing there to provide tips and assistance.
Oh, we're always around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One thing that we did also, it turns out right at the start of the pandemic, we created our Erwin Hubbard Writers of the Future online workshop. And we did 13 video interviews, I think, with Scott Card, Tim Powers, and Dave Farland.
That was on craft, right?
It was on craft.
Yeah, they're some of the best on craft, those three that you just mentioned.
Yeah. And then all the L. Ron Hubbard essays that they're going to read as a winner. And this is the first time we've actually had the workshop where everybody had to get through that online writing course for coming here. So then they were able to even devote more time to business and the next level above that, because they've already gone this now, so now they could actually get even more in depth.
So stuff like what I'm going to say this afternoon to the gang, you know, about indie publishing and all of that.
They're ready for that now, and they can see that because they've already, we're taking it to the next level with them. But that's one thing about Writers of the Future now, because we've had over 800 winners now over the 37 years. And like I said, we just, year 38 finished on September 30th, and now we're in the contest now. It has started. We're in the first quarter of year 39.
It just boggles my mind. I still remember walking across that stage, up there. Actually, it wasn't much of a stage. It was like a step up, a little platform they put. And it was, Robert Silverberg was standing up there, and Algis Budrus had a tux on behind the podium. And then it was Roger Zelazny and Greg Benford, who was really new at the time. I'm not very far behind Greg. They were all I walked up there and kind of went, wow, this is cool. And AJ said, Dean, I can trust you to do this. That's what he said on the set. He says, I want you to be the first to cross the stage, see if we have some mistakes that we're doing. Because it was the very first. And it worked like clockwork, And AJ was over there behind the podium, and that was the first tux. Where now you guys are, it's all big event and tuxes and everything. AJ was the first tux.
He loved that, being able to do the tuxedo drill.
Yeah.
Yeah. So on, because I've talked to various people on, so you're saying put 20 books, have your bakery shelf full on that. But in terms of conventions, how much was that part of the start of your career, attending conventions, building a fan base?
It was a different world back then. I sold a whole bunch of I had an agent, but my agent never sold a book. I sold all 106 of my traditional books myself, or I was called by a publisher and said, Dean, would you do this? That was a different world back in the 80s and 90s, completely different. It doesn't function that way anymore. And we had to go to conventions. I would be sitting at a dinner and end up selling a book at that dinner. Now everything has to, go through committees and all the other stuff. And there's so few publishers now that traditional publishers that it's just not worth it. Going out and meeting other people and writers and things like that, that's still worth it. But the conventions have changed. Now you want to be at something like Comic-Con or
Dragon Con and Salt Lake City Fanex are my two favorite. Were there
exactly
huge book readers there?
Absolutely, those are two of the best. And the old science fiction conventions and stuff now are more. They've kind of gone a different way, and they're not a lot of the pros are going. and which is really sad. I kind of miss it. But in 1992, I think was the year that we finally decided that's too much, is that we went to 26 conventions in a year. It means every other weekend we were at a convention, usually Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. But we had to. That was part of our business back then. Now you do not need to do that. Now everything's online and videos and everything else. But I would go to the Comic-Con, to Dragon Con, to Salt Lake. There's four or five that I would go to. I don't go to them much anymore.
Is Gen Con up where you came? Where?
Yeah.
Not so much?
I'm not much that side of things.
Yeah.
I did a lot of gaming novels and stuff, but I don't. Ones that we're pushing now is the Licensing Expo, which is in Las Vegas in May. And we will be there. We'll have a big suite there. We'll have a lot of the writers. One of our big workshops in our online thing is aiming for the licensing. So we will have people understanding what, because everything in writing is licensing. Mm-hmm. In fact, you don't sell anything. You license everything. And so we're really focusing on the Licensing Expo. That's our next big push. And we were just starting to push at it. And
pandemic.
Yeah. So it's been a couple years now. Now we're trying to retrain and get ourselves back up and thinking and getting the writers for coming. So we'll have a big suite where everybody, you know, the writers can come up and talk about what they saw at the licensing that day in, because it's so huge that, you know, you can't see it all. In fact, I was there for 3 days the year before the pandemic and I didn't begin to see it all.
Wow.
And, you know, a couple other people and I are together. We're going to be forming a company if we can get this license out of CBS. And we're trying to get the Twilight Zone magazine license. And so we've been in negotiations with CBS for the magazine. And, you know, we haven't got very far yet because we were just getting, and then pandemic.
Boom.
And so we will be back in that and trying to work on it. But we're trying to pull the magazine, Twilight Zone magazine license out of the Twilight Zone stuff that CBS has and just fire back up, because in the late 70s and early 80s, there was a Twilight Zone magazine. And I sold stories to it. And I'll be the editor because I edit Pulp House, which is basically Pulp House is Twilight Zone. Mm-hmm. Except it's under a different name because I buy Twilight Zone type stories when I can find them. And I would be the editor. And we'd have this group of people that have other companies that we're going to come together and form another company just for the magazine if we can get the license. So that's the kind of thing that we're doing. And as writers, you take your stuff in and you license it. You can, if you get the right kind of artwork deal, where you guys are having your own artwork, I assume you get the full license on all the artwork. You can do anything from mugs to T-shirts to games to... You know, we tried our first game and it got stuck in China. I'm having to refund everybody on the game for one of Chris's novels, Diving. But it was a really nifty little card game with dice and all that. And it was really, really cool and had great art and everything else. And it's somewhere between here and China. We can't find it.
Wow.
Yeah, can't find it. And I've finally given up. It's been a year. It got sent to China in November of last year. So almost a year. And then 3 months went by, and that company closed because of the pandemic. And so we moved it to another company. They theoretically shipped it in May.
Wow.
And it's only 1,000 copies. And so we're going to stay in the States from now on out. It's more expensive per unit, but by the time you get all the problems, you know, in this whole thing. So our first attempt at a game license for one of our works did not go well.
Right.
Did not go well. But we're learning. That's what you do. You make mistakes and you learn and then go on.
And then for you, you take it and you make one of your lessons that people can sign up. So you can learn from our mistakes.
As soon as we get the full lesson, we'll figure out how to do it right first. We got to do some. And so we were going to go to the licensing conference too. So that's really where we're headed, and that's where the modern world is headed, is the writers are – put it this way, we do a lot of book sales because we're around the world, but Chris and I make far more money licensing than we ever do on book sales, which is a license also, but it's a license to Amazon to license our book, you know, to other people. We make far more money in licensing than we ever do in book sales, and we make a lot of money also in crowdfunding. We do Kickstarters. We do 6 Kickstarters a year. on for different projects. Chris had a book she wrote in the pandemic just because she wanted to escape, and it was in her Spade Paladin series, which actually wasn't a series, it was the first book. And it's a mystery set at a science fiction convention. Really fun. And a 90s science fiction convention. And even though she has it today, the convention is like the old 90s convention. So it's really fun. She didn't know what to do with it. We were just going to publish it. And we said, well, let's do a Kickstarter on it. And so we put it up on Kickstarter and included some workshops and other stuff with it, you know, because we have that side too. And it made $30,000. I mean, that's if she'd have sold that to a traditional publisher, she'd have made 5 or 10. You know, mm-hmm. because it's just, it was a one-off, one-shot series that nobody even knew about. And she had a few short stories in it, and that was about it. And she, one book, put it up on Kickstarter, got all this promotion on Kickstarter. She made over almost $30,000 on that. And then the pre-orders on the book, because we sent the book to all the Kickstarter people early, the pre-orders to actually buy the book just exploded. And it was
so how's that actually work? So, mm-hmm. I've not done a Kickstarter myself.
Oh, you guys need to be doing Kickstarters. Yes.
So how does that work? Because I thought people were paying so that you could have the money to make a product.
Well, that's one of the things that people do. But no, we already had this book done. It was already completely put together and finished and everything else. And then we said, you want to read it early? Back the Kickstarter. And then we have other products on there too, because we do have the big teaching wing of WMG makes all the money. I make no money off the teaching. I do it basically for free, but it helps go, it goes into the company so mm-hmm. we can do lots of other stuff and have all of our employees and everything. But so we had workshops that we literally gave away. I gave away $900 in workshops in stretch goals because the thing just kept hitting stretch goals. We expected to do $10,000 on that Kickstarter. It went to way, way higher. So we kept adding stretch goals. And so we would give another book away and another one of what we call pop-ups, which are basically an hour-long lecture of me just on one specific topic. We gave, I think, $900 at $150 each. We gave that many pop-ups away in the stretch goals. And so people were going, oh, wow. And then they would start spreading the word. Hey, if you get on this, you get all these things, you know. And we have a Kickstarter going right now for Holiday Spectacular, which is a As we talk here in, at Writers of the Future, we just launched it yesterday. And our ask was $2,500. We went by that in just under an hour. Just boom, went right by it. And basically what that is it's an advent calendar of fiction. Chris edits it. It's all original stories from all kinds of writers, some of the top writers working in short fiction. And we send to the people from the 25th of November, which is American Thanksgiving, to the 1st of January. They get a story in their device
every day.
And Chris has an essay introducing it, saying, this is a dark story. So if you're not in a good mood, you might not want to read this today. Maybe save it for when you're feeling better. You know, or this is a light, fun story. And then they go into three collections, too. And so there's like three collections and then this advent calendar and we're kickstarting it. We're hoping that it does pretty well, you know.
Pays for your Christmas present for Chris?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we don't.
Her new Maserati.
Yeah, yeah. Well, don't give her ideas.
So on the whole thing of how things have changed, because that's, mm-hmm. I mean, even when I started doing this podcast 3 years ago, so much has changed and continues to change.
Continuously, yeah.
In publishing. So it used to be attending conventions and mm-hmm. Was a way to go to meet an audience. Mm-hmm. What about book signings, whether they're virtual or in store?
They're not worth it. They're not worth it. They're not worth the time to set up. They're not worth the return on investment. They never really were. I didn't know this as a young writer until I was standing in a New York office, one of my editor's offices, and I had just got hired for to do Strange New Worlds. And one of the assistants came in and they say, so-and-so is talking about wanting to do a tour and, you know, signing tour. And the editor talked, and they said, bring so-and-so in here. And I'm standing there. They just sort of like forgot I was now part of their staff,
right?
You know, and I'm standing there, and I'm listening, and they go, well, should we do this? And they said, oh, give him a mercy tour. You know, basically, it was to please the author, give him three or four cities, and let him do five or six bookstores and signing. And it was a mercy tour. It was a part of their production, their promotion budget at that point, because it's totally worthless. It did nothing. How you find readers now is just put out good books and be online and be sociable. And if you're on social media, remember that the word is social. You need to not just talk about your book. You need to be, buy my book. No, you don't do that. You talk about your cats, or you talk about whatever's interesting to you as a social thing. And then every so often say, I got a new book out. And then if they like you and you have like that, then they'll go and pass the word and get it. And it's word of mouth. And there's an old cliche in publishing. The best promotion for your book is your next book. Because someone will find your next book, and then they'll go back and read your previous book. And boy, does that work. I had always said that, and I'd always knew that. But it wasn't until Code Poker Gang took off that I was already 10 books in. And they were selling a couple books a month, each one of them. And I was just writing them because I loved them. And I wasn't writing them all one right after another and doing all that silliness. I was writing one, and then 6 months or 8 months later, I'd write another one, because I write a novel every month. And so they just kind of trickled along. And pretty soon I looked up and there was 10 of them. And then when Chris got sick and we were moving to Vegas, basically what occurred was Gwyneth, one of the people that worked for us, she's fantastic. She said, can I do some promotion on this? Because I told them, no promotion. I'm a science fiction writer. I wasn't known for writing mystery. And she said, can I do a book bub on this? And I said, well, sure. Go ahead, see if you can get one. Well, she got one. Never told me about it at all because I didn't want to know about anything. And one morning, Chris woke me up and she said, you're number one on Amazon. And I'm like, what? I had no idea. I said, was it the last Thunder Mountain that just took off? And she said, oh, no, it was one of your Cold Poker. It was your first Cold Poker Gang novel. And I'm like, why? It's been selling like 3 or 4 copies a month for 9 years. She said, no, it's gone to number one. And then, of course, all the other books. And we made more in sales on that one than we did in all of our book sales for the previous year. We did more in 2 months. And if I didn't have those 10 books out, when it exploded, when its time came,
it wouldn't have had
wouldn't that, have done it. If I'd have been promoting the heck out of it way back, it would have been, that's that book. But nobody even knew it existed. And suddenly they were, there's a whole new series by Dean Wesley Smith. Oh, we didn't know it was there. Mm-hmm. And it just exploded. And that's what happens in publishing.
Yeah. But you did mention BookBub, because that is a definite
promotional
tool that it has proven very effective, specifically for the publishing industry.
Absolutely. It's wonderful. And you should be reading, as a young writer, I would recommend that you read the books that are coming out and the blurbs on the books coming out from BookBub every day, all our newsletters, because that's a learning experience all by itself. But don't try for a BookBub until you're up around the 20, because otherwise you got nothing to sell. They buy one book and then you're done. It's like, and then they don't remember you, because readers nowadays are very, they forget really quickly. But if you've got 10 books and you got them reading for a month of your stuff.
Your name they're going to remember.
That's why the 20.
Yeah. Okay, good. So this has been great having this chance to talk with you. So one more time, how people can actually find your books besides waiting for the next book bub.
Finding information about me, deanwesleysmith.com.
Okay.
Dean Wesley, Wesley Smith.com. The best place is my publishing site, wmgpublishinginc.com. And that is completely searchable for my books, Chris's books, our magazines, everything we're doing. But on deanwesleysmith.com, you can also, there are links to how to get to the workshops, and there's a curriculum, there's all kinds of stuff on that. I blog every day. I have a streak going now that's a little over 9 years that I haven't missed a day, which, considering computer outages and internet outages and big storms and things like that, I have not missed a day for 9 years.
Wow.
Now, some of the blogs are, I'm still here, I'm still alive, go away. And then other blogs are, right now, I'm writing a book online, a nonfiction book online that is, I'm sadly taking traditional publishing apart, but I'm doing it one chapter at a time, and like every other week or so, I put up another chapter, and so people can follow along and read the entire book online.
Wow.
And things like that. So DeanWesleySmith.com or WMGPublishingInc.com.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Dean. It's been great speaking with you.
It's been fun. Been fun talk.
Great. And thank you for listening. Subscribe to the Writers of the Future podcast wherever you get your podcasts. The Writers of the Future podcast is available on SoundCloud, iTunes, Google Play, Pocket Cast, Stitcher, Player FM, iHeart, and Spotify. And it's also been globally syndicated on the United Public Radio Network. Writers and Illustrators of the Future are contests created by Elrond Hubbard to provide a means for the aspiring writer and artist to be seen and acknowledged. It is free to enter and open to new and amateur short story writers and artists of science fiction or fantasy. Again, thanks very much, Dean.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.